your tears on my pillow that won't dry on the road beyond my ears. I've no sorrow, but today I don't walk alone. Step by step.
How's everyone doing tonight? We're going to have an AA meeting. Welcome to the Fort Lauderdale Primary Purpose Big Book Study Group's Thursday night Alcoholics and God Speaker Step Series. I'm a recovered alcoholic. My name is Jared. Thank you for joining us tonight. In a minute, we're going to start our two-minute meditation. So please take a moment to get situated. Please turn off all devices that will make noise or might distract others. Take this time to get connected to God. Let the craziness of the day drift away and ask God to help you stay focused on the step study tonight. Is everyone ready?
Yes.
Let's start the meditation. In front of your seat, or you could follow along with right here. God, let your love shine through me like a heart light, so those who are lost, sick, and dying can find your love through me. There is a solution from the big book, page 17. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out in which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. I've asked Mike Chase to read Appendix 2, Spiritual Experience. We read this because the main purpose of the 12 steps is to have one, so it's kind of important to know what one is. Yeah. Oh, they're not bad. I can see everybody. Hi. Spiritual. You know, at the back of my book, when we finish up spiritual experience in big quotes, we have this, what if? You know, don't shut yourself down to any experience of any kind. Be open-minded to this stuff. The term spiritual experience and spiritual awakening are used many times in this book, which upon careful reading shows that the personality change sufficient to recover from alcoholism has manifested itself among us in many different forms. Yet it is true that our first printing gave many readers the impression that these personality changes or religious experiences must be in the nature of sudden and spectacular upheavals. Happily for everyone, this conclusion is erroneous. That's wrong. In the first few chapters, a number of sudden revolutionary changes are described. Though it was not our intention to create such an impression, many alcoholics have nevertheless concluded that in order to recover, they must acquire an immediate and overwhelming God consciousness, followed at once by a vast change of feeling and outlook. Among a rapidly growing membership of thousands of alcoholics, such transformations, though frequent, are by no means the rule. Most of our experiences are what the psychologist William James calls the educational variety, because they develop slowly over a period of time. Quite often, friends of the newcomer are aware of the difference long before he is himself. He finally realizes that he has undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life. I'm going to say that again. He finally realizes that he's undergone a profound alteration in his reaction to life, that such a change could hardly have been brought about by himself alone. What often takes place in a few months could seldom have been accomplished by years of self-discipline. With few exceptions, our members find that they have tapped an unsuspected inner resource, which they presently identify with their own conception of a power greater than themselves. Most of us think this awareness of a power greater than ourselves is the essence of a spiritual experience. Our more religious members call it God consciousness. Most emphatically, we wish to say that any alcoholic capable of honestly facing his problems in the light of our experience can recover, provided he does not close his mind to all spiritual concepts. He can only be defeated by an attitude of intolerant or belligerent denial. We find that no one need have difficulty with the spirituality of the program. Willingness, honesty, and open-mindedness are the essentials of recovery, but these are indispensable. There is a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot keep a man from everlasting ignorance, and that principle is contempt prior to investigation. Herbert Spencer, Alcoholics Anonymous, page 567-58. Thanks, Jared.
Please refrain from disturbing others by talking or constantly getting up and sitting back down. Once again, this is a tech-free meeting. If you need to use the phone or text, there's a nice lobby outside. Please set your phones to airplane or meeting mode, or just turn them off completely. Tonight we have Joe B. with his seventh week, I believe. We are blessed to have him here. I've been blessed to have this group and the work that we're doing here, and I look forward to another 5 weeks with Joe. So here's Joe.
It is better with those lights up back there. Hi, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Joe. Good to be here. It's such a privilege to be able to do this. I was going to wear the hat, but I don't need to now. You know, that does solve the problem. Where's Mike at? You know, when you bring those lights up back there, these aren't so bad. I mean, they're bad, but they're not so bad. Oh, it's good to be here, and man, what a difference it makes when you take your time and being able to get here and you leave early, you know? Like last week, it was raining, and 95 stunk, and like, you know, when you're running really, really, like, tight on a schedule, everybody knows this, that, you know, because I love to get here early and pray with the group that goes back there and prays, and I wasn't able to make that last week, so I really felt like I fell on my face when I was doing step six. So I'm going to kind of regress a little bit and talk about that, but I just want to say that I'm very honored tonight that John W. is here. He is my teacher, my sponsor for many years, and just a beautiful man, and taught me everything I know about life, everything I know about life, everything I know about being a grown-up. You know, being a man of commitment and maturity, most of the time. But I didn't know any of that stuff until I came into contact with him. And talk a little bit more about that. And I'm also honored to have, you know, several champions of mine that mean the world to me, Peter and Michael and his group of men. And I say men because, you know, this whole thing is about growing up. You know, it's all about growing up and taking on attributes and things in our character that are esteemable and attractable. Because ultimately, when we come in here, we engage in a program not only to become free of alcohol and whatever other substance that we're addicted to, but also to become teachers, you know, to always remain to be students, but to become teachers so that, you know, we can conduct ourselves in such a way that when we walk into a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, that the person that's sitting there shaking like a $3 outboard sees something in us that attracts them, that engages their heart and their spirit to where they say, man, I would love to be able to experience just what I believe that person is experiencing. Takes a lot of work. But we start on day one. You know, when we read Spiritual Experience, that is such a phenomenal reading. You know, if you haven't looked at it, please, you know, go and ask yourself what it means to you. You know, they talk about spiritual experience and spiritual awakening being mentioned many times in the book. And we see it, you know, we see it actually when we read the doctor's opinion. You know, right up front, Dr. Silkworth gives us an expression, you know, some words that really express what a spiritual experience would be, what this awakening of the experience would consist of. You know, and he talks about it when he says entire psychic change. There's many things in the book that when you see them termed and you see the description that they have in there, it doesn't just have to say spiritual experience or spiritual awakening. You know, it means this transformation, this transformative thing that happens to us. Like I always like to describe it like a caterpillar to a butterfly, where we come in one individual and we go through this process of acknowledgement, investigation, identification, realization, refinement, and we emerge. We go through this refinement process and this restitution process, reconciliation process, and we emerge a butterfly. We emerge a different human being. We hear the promises mentioned all the time in the beginning of almost a lot of meetings, I'll say that. Not this meeting. Not the meeting that my home group is. We talk about the promises when we get to the promises. But I'm going to talk to them a little bit early because they're in the nine step phase of the process. When we start to make amends, when we start to go through that period of reconciliation, where we start to set right the wrongs with the individuals that we have harmed, that we've been blaming the whole time, right? And through the fourth and the fifth step, we come to find out, well, my God, I set this whole thing up. Or in most cases, you know, where I was at fault, where I'm the one that set the ball rolling, where I'm the one that initiated the process based on selfishness and self-centered motives, right? I started to gain people. I started to work people. And all of a sudden, they retaliate. But I never got past that. With all the relationships that I had, once they retaliated, I blamed them for everything. I held them responsible for everything. And I didn't even understand the things that motivated me to get satisfied in some area of my life, in some part of my life. I was gaming them to get satisfied. I was looking to get something. I was looking for a payoff in that relationship that later placed me in a position to be hurt. But I never was able to look at that. You know, I've talked about when I got here, I was a complete victim. You know, John described a victim as somebody that walks around with this big V etched in their forehead. You see them all the time. You know, they're walking around, they're angry, they're, you know, they're kind of people that you want to stay away from. Unless you're the same kind of person like I was, and that's the person that I would gravitate to, because they're the only people that would listen to me, right? But to get back to this spiritual awakening, this is the gift that God saw fit to grant us. You know, I can think of many people on earth, many groups of types of people that probably are worthy of a gift that we've been given, probably a little bit more than us, given what we do before we get here, right? There's a lot of people out there think about the gift that we actually are able to have in the way of a spiritual awakening. You know, all through my life, I was a reactor. I responded to things. You know, I was going through life and I was basing my reaction and my thought process and my response on things that I would see, things that I would hear, you know, things that I, you know, all my five senses, what I would taste, what I would touch, what I would hear, what I would see, and what I would, you know, what's the other one? Feel, right? No, touch, huh? Smell. I got terrible sinuses, so that's why that kind of like, you know, I can't smell nothing. But, you know, everything that I based my decisions on and my, you know, that would create, you know, this thought process that would be, these feelings would come from and these emotions would come from, would be from my five senses. I had never developed any kind of access to the spiritual world, to the spirit. And that's what this whole thing is all about. It's about gaining access to a sixth sense that has been choked off by all my appetites and desires and demands of life, of the world, right? When I got here as a man in the world, a man of the world. I was addicted to the world. I was addicted to the flesh. I was addicted to anything that made me feel good, that would give me relief, give me ease and comfort, right? Silkworth says it right up front. You know, we're restless, irritable, discontent. The things that we do, the ways we are with other people, the shortcuts we take, all the things that we do to hurt other people, you know, create this internal condition. And that has me in a constant state of always wanting to seek a sense of ease and comfort. He says we get, and that creates restlessness, irritability, discontent, right? Unless we can again experience a sense of ease and comfort that comes in a split second by taking a drink, right? Now he's talking about somebody that's sober. There's a lot of people in here, right? There's a lot of people in here tonight that probably are suffering from that restlessness, irritability, discontentedness, and you're not drinking and you're not drugging, right? We have to replace the sense of ease and comfort we always got from drinking and drugging with something that will work. And they say that when we seek and gain this access to this spirit, that we will have a sense of ease and comfort with certainty through all ups and downs. It will solve all our problems. A lot of people will come into recovery and seek her or seek him for a sense of ease and comfort, or seek gambling for a sense of ease and comfort, or some other thing, some other worldly thing, you know? But it's not constant. It's not with certainty in all times of good and bad, especially when we come in and within the first 3 months we're getting involved in a relationship. The only person I could attract when I got here in the first few months that I was here, and I was a bug. I mean, I was so broken and so scattered The only thing that I asked that man to do was just lead me through the next few hours of every day. I was scared to death to think on my own because I had evidence. I had evidence of what I was able to produce with what was going on in my mind. I don't recall the evidence that I created when I was completely wiped out and drugged up and drunk. But I did have evidence, right? So, I mean, I the only person that I could have attracted was somebody that it was at least on my level. That's healthy, isn't it? And we wonder why new relationships and recovery don't work or last. You know why? Because I'm not emotionally sober. I'm completely broken. The only thing that I can relate to is brokenness. But my codependency, my need, my insatiable need for a sense of ease and comfort leads me to her. Because you know what? She's smiling at me. Oh my God. You know what I mean? It's like all of a sudden I feel like Superman. I forget about all the brokenness. If I can only forget about the brokenness, if I can only forget about the shattered life that I've led, that I have standing in front of me, my God, what am I going to do about the past? My God, what am I going to do about the future? I need to just shut down for a little while. I need to forget about that. And then I invite somebody into my life that doubles up, that doubles it down because they bring their brokenness into the deal. It's impossible. It is impossible for me to attempt to seek a life, seek a relationship, do the things that I need to do that demand 100% emotional focus. Demand it. Where I'm still having all this other brokenness come into my life. It doesn't work. They say in the book that I need to be reasonably sure of my sobriety. And by the way, sobriety means a whole lot more than undrunk and undrunkenness. You know what I'm saying? A whole lot more. That I need to be reasonably sure of my emotional sobriety before I have her come back into my life. They're talking about not just a significant other, but even a married couple, even a wife, even a family. Because if I bring them back too soon, my emotional focus goes 90% on that and 10% on this. And ever wonder why? It never works. Listen, everybody has facts. You're entitled to your own opinion. You're just not entitled to your own facts. Facts are facts. And over 80 years of experience, it is so crystal clear that if I don't give myself a shot to wipe out all the other things that are so consuming in my mind in order to recover from a fatal disease, it doesn't happen. See, what happens is I'll come in with all the intentions in the world. All the best of intentions. I will do anything. I help a lot of men. And I know there's people in here that help a lot of men. The men that make me leery the most are the ones that come in and say, I know what I need to do. Really? Let's take a look at the evidence of what you've been able to accomplish with all that you know. That's what that man told me. All my scorecards read zero. That was the facts. But my intentions were crystal clear and honorable intentions. I'll do anything. Well, you need to get rid of her. Well, come on. You need to get into a different type of career because the one you're in requires you to lie and bend the truth and hurt people on the other end of that telephone. Well, I don't know about that. It's the money. It's the this. It's the, you know what I mean? All of a sudden, when I'm confronted with the change that I say I want, I start to have conditions. There's only one thing that booze and drugs will do. They will beat me into a place where none of that matters anymore. I'll hold on as long as I can for the things that I think I need, these instinctual needs, these appetites that I think I have to have, until I am so broken, if not dead, in order to give them up. That's just the facts, people. That is just the facts. Every single one of us in here knows somebody that's died as a direct result of this disease. Everybody in here knows somebody. I know many. I've been to many, many funerals. And there's men in here that have been to many, many more than I have. And those people had the intention of doing anything to get better, except when it came to giving up the things they thought they needed in order to get better. Right? So I say all that because there's people just like me that would not let go of what I thought I needed in life in order to move forward. Now, when I did that four-step inventory, it became crystal clear that this guy was a vessel of selfishness and self-centeredness. I was so self-consumed, I did not have the ability to have compassion for another human being, to have empathy for another human being, to have kindness for another human being, to have any kind of morality within me, right? The only time I was those things was when I wanted something, when I was looking for a payoff, when I was looking for some type of a reward from the individual that I had to pretend of being that in order to get what it is I wanted. So there was no authenticity involved in me. I was a player. I was the actor they talk about in the book. Always wanting to arrange the lights, the ballet, and the scenery in my own way. Because I knew if I had it in my way, you'd like it too. I was walking around, I was getting up every single morning, writing a script of how not only I was supposed to be and perform, but how you were supposed to be and respond to me. And I knew that if you did, and if I did it right, and you responded the right way, my life would be great. The problem was, I'm not the only one that had a script in my hand. All y'all had one too. So everybody's walking around with a script in their hand, and the book calls it a battle of the instincts. A battle of my appetites versus your appetites. My instinctual needs versus your instinctual needs. And it was all conflictual. So I had become this vessel of conflict. Chaos on the inside, pretending that everything was great on the outside. I didn't want you to know my brokenness. I didn't want you to see my brokenness or hear my brokenness. God forbid you see that. What would you think of me? My whole life was centered around having you like me, or think highly of me, or think a certain way of me. I was consumed with what you thought of me. So I had no relationship with the Creator that created me specifically to perform for Him. I was performing for you. So who was my God? Oh, I'd acknowledge Him, but you were my God. You were the ones that I was seeking approval from, validation from, acceptance from, credit from, applause from. You were the ones that I lived for. And through all that performance and all that pretending and all that masquerading, I became a nobody. You could give it to me, you could acknowledge me, you could give me credit for things that I was intentionally seeking from you. And I would go home and lay my head on my pillow at night and know you were giving it to a complete an utter fraud. That's what this thing does to people. That's why I drank. That's why I drugged. I couldn't stand being in reality for 1 second. I couldn't stand it. So I was always looking for a sense of ease and comfort. And it all came from the pursuit of satisfaction for those instincts. It all came from there. That's why in the inventory process, the central column is all about the instincts of character. The personal security. What do you think of me? How do I look? You know? Are you noticing me? What are you thinking? I was always worried. I was always worried and wondering what you were thinking. Why? I don't know. But because you weren't saying what you were thinking, I'd make up what you were thinking. You know what I'm saying? What are they thinking? What am I saying? What are they? You know, I could be the guy walking down the street in my sickness, and I'm walking down one side of the street on the sidewalk, and about 50 feet away on the other side of the street, on the other sidewalk, there's a couple walking this way, right? So I'm going this way, and they're coming this way. And as our paths cross, all of a sudden, they burst out into laughter. Who do you think I think they're laughing at? How do they know what's going on inside of me? How dare they laugh at this loser? Because that's what I felt like, a loser, a failure. Right? That's what I felt. That's what I thought of me. So whatever I was thinking about you, about what you were thinking about me, was what was really going on inside of me. Right? What a way to live. I had to drink. I had to drug. This program, when we talk about the gift, the spiritual awakening, the spiritual experience, the gift that God has given us as the prize for the simple work we have to do, is nothing short of miraculous. It's complete freedom, complete liberation from that guy, from that person who's in bondage to themselves and their self-centeredness and their selfishness. Oh my God, man. I drank and drugged because I hated and couldn't stand me. And that was the result of always trying to get what I wanted from you. It is mind-boggling when you go through this thing and you're able to look back and stand on the other side and go, holy cow. You know, when I did that deep dive in the confession in step 5, I was able to see who you got. Even though I was still harboring a lot of the same stuff because I hadn't done any of the corrective work as a result of step 5. That was to come. But at least I was able to see what was broken. Prior to doing 4 and 5, I blamed you for all my crap. I blamed you for the way I felt. And I was sure you felt the same way. But I stopped saying, man, why is my life so screwed up? Which is what I always used to say. And after I did that dive in 5, I said, my God, no wonder my life's so screwed up. Of course it's screwed up. How could it not be screwed up? Given how I operated. Given how I lived life and navigated through this thing. Right? And then the corrective measures started to happen. That's why they say in 6, this is a step that separates the men from the boy. In other words, there's got to be some growth here. In other words, if I'm a boy and I'm going to do this step 6 and 7, there's going to be some period, major period of growth. If there's not, then I'm just reading those 2 little paragraphs and I'm saying to myself, well, I'm glad that's over with. Glad that's done. What's next? And wonder why everybody that I make amends to goes, yeah, okay, whatever. Because it's the same guy, right? There has to be some period of maturity, but I have to have that fire burning on the inside, that desire to become the man that I had never been, right? I hope everybody has that fire just burning inside them. To experience somebody looking back at them in the mirror from the person they were when they got here. If I knew I had to be that person and not drink because I was certain to die because of the physical destruction from alcoholism, if I had to feel and act and be the same way and live in the same mind, I wouldn't. I'd drink. I'd drug or put a bullet in my brain. In 5, we we discover, right? It's all a discovery thing. This investigation that we do and this confession that we have, that we're able to do in the presence of God with our sponsors, we uncover all the things that drove us and motivated us and influenced us and the appetites that we had. God says, look, I'm going to give you these instincts, these instinctual needs so that you can survive on earth, so that you can be reasonably comfortable and reasonably sure and safe and protected when it comes to shelter and your health and financially, so you can provide for you and your family and sexually so you can procreate. I mean, they spell out instincts of character and why they're given to us in step 4 and the 12 and 12. They're listed. I mean, the creation, God, the creator, gave us instincts for a reason. But then something happens. And you know what? These instinctual needs, when they're met, they make us feel good. They give us ease and comfort. They give us a spike in our sense of worth and feeling, right? An emotional state. The problem is that we go all out in trying to get more. Because it feels good, and it'll feel better if I get more, and I feel better if I get more. And I'm trampling on everybody in order to satisfy them. And it says when they dominate us or drive us blindly, that's the degree of separation that we go from what God intended as to what we wanted, right? And I got that. I was so clear about that. And I still am today. I know when I'm jammed up, it's because I want something that either I can't have, or I'm afraid I'm going to lose something that I have, or I just don't feel satisfied. I think the greatest state of sanity is just being okay with what is. Right? My sponsor talks about this fourth dimension. I still feel somewhat confident that the dimension of the spiritual dimension, this relationship that begins to happen that was never available to me, this intimacy, this absolute knowing beyond the belief, started with a belief, became a knowing that God is with me, that He is my Father, that He is my Creator, that He's my everything. He's my comfort. He's my peace, my protector, my safety, my motivator, He's my everything. I know this for me, I know it. This is part of that awakening, this gift that they give us, right? But my sponsor says it's also this dimension that we're like catapulted. You know, alcoholics and drug addicts, we always are living in the past or we're living in the future, right? And they're not comfortable places to live. Like when we're sitting still and we're quiet by ourselves and we're thinking about and being daunted by nothing but the things that had happened yesterday or 10 minutes ago or 6 years ago or 20 years ago, and it's like it's all consuming. It's a conversation that we can't shut down, right? And it's deafening. And if we're not thinking about from here back, we're thinking about from here forward, about what's tomorrow, when is this, you know, what's going to happen in 10 minutes, what's going to happen, you know, what. He talks about this fourth dimension as the dimension of nowness, like being catapulted to like now. Like being okay with like right now, and then now, and then now. What an awesome thing to be okay with like, wow, this is cool. 7:56, I am okay at 7:56. And not be consumed with 7:54. What did I say? Did they like it? Did they not? You know, really. Sanity. Soundness of mind. God. That was such a foreign concept when I got here. Soundness of mind. Nowness. Being okay with what I have rather than unokay with what I don't have. See, if I'm unokay with what I don't have, I'm chasing. I'm chasing. I'm always chasing. It's dominating my thinking. It's dominating my thoughts, my feelings, my actions. It's dominating everything, right? So if I'm chasing you to like me, you to think I look good, if I'm trying to control everything and I'm always consumed with looking good, right? If I'm always worried about money, if I'm always chasing money, I want the better job and I don't have enough this and I don't have enough that, right? And it's consuming my mind. And I'm like sexually just like off the chain, and I've got to have that. I got to be validated. I got to have my masculinity. I got to make sure that they know I'm masculine. Like all this garbage that's going on in my mind. It's chaos. Where is God in that? Where is sanity in that? Where's soundness of mind in that? It's not there. It is not there. So this process lets us see how all that has affected our lives. And listen, that's not even taking into consideration the collateral damage. What we produced out there. What we affected out there. What we infected out there. It's too much. So we put it on paper. And we do the deep dive in five. In the presence of God with our sponsors. And they're able to like make sure we discover the exact nature of the wrong. Like what was the hurt? What did you cause in other people? Their emotions, their feelings, their mental states, their sobriety. How was that rattled and shattered through the act of the harm? And we got it all down. Because you know what? If I don't look at this, I'm going to create it again. I'm going to do it again and again and again and again. Because I'm habitual. I don't think I'm hurting people until I see that I have. Because if I don't go into this process with all my heart and all my emotions and all my focus, if I'm diverted with her, if I'm diverted with it, this is not going to get done. It's going to continue. I will be who I've always been. It can't not happen. Am I in this game to become somebody new or to remain that person that's old? See, this whole deal, when we do our four-step inventory, the list that we make of people that we hurt and the institutions and the financial harms and all that stuff, and we make that list, those are the people that are going to be reconfigured on our A-step list. That's why they say, We look at step eight, we have our list, we did it when we made step four, when we did step four. I talk about what they did to me, that's the victim place, right? I talk about what it affects, because if I don't identify what it affected in me, my instincts, my appetites, my desires, I'm going to continue to want to satisfy them over and above what is due me. I got to see how this thing happens. And then how did I set the ball rolling? What was the game? But the most important part about it was, what was the fuel? What was the thing that emanated from within me that had me work you and gain you for more of that? See, if I don't look at the exact nature of this deal, then I'm not going to make amends for the exact nature of this deal. It's going to be shallow and cerebral, and it's not going to land. It's not going to work. I'm going to go and I'm going to say, I'm sorry. Have you ever had anybody do that to you? I mean, they really hurt you. Like, you really, like, you're out to help them and you really want to help them and you're doing things and you're making concessions and you're making sacrifices and you're really trying to be of help and be of service. And then they just dish you and just completely ignore you. When the time comes for, you know, you to get together, right? And they go, I'm sorry. Do you know that's who our loved ones get if we don't do this incorrectly? They get the same person that said, I'm sorry, 1,000 times. And that's when they simply go, yeah, okay, whatever. And nothing is rectified. No amends. No wrong is righted. This thing's serious, people. It's fatal. It's fatal. Right? So 6 and 7 is all about that process, that corrective process, that refinement process, where I take the guy that I had become and little by slowly on a daily basis, beginning with making the decision to turn my will and my life over to God's care and committing to take an inventory and talking to somebody about it, committing to change, being willing to give up those defects of character, committing to change and asking God for help. I cannot fix me. I can only hope to do this with a commitment and desire in my heart to become the man that God created me to be and surround myself with a group of people and a group of men and a sponsor that cares more about me than I do, cares more about my future than I do, and will not worry about my feelings and tell me the cold truth, tell me the hard truth. A man told me a long time ago, I'd rather step on your feelings than walk in your grave. And I found out I was a whole bag of stuff. Self-centered, liar, habitual liar. Incredibly inconsiderate, extremely selfish, self-centered, right? Self-consumed. You just ask me, what are you thinking about me? I'm thinking about me. I'm thinking about me. Russell says it best. He stood one time in a meeting, and he goes, really, I'm just a selfish, self-centered pig. I go, holy crap, that's perfect. That's exactly what I am. It really was. Lustful, greedy, slothful, lazy, gluttonous. Always wanted to steal stuff before. You know, the thing is today, I don't, you know, the thing is with these defects of character, the ones that are, I believe that the ones that we do that are that result in criminal consequence, they're the ones that go away the quickest. For me, it's kind of like, you know, I don't do things, and I don't even have an appetite to do things that would get me arrested today. Before, I never cared about that. I was always dodging, juking, and jiving, right? That was my MO. Because I never wanted to work for anything. I always wanted it easy. I wanted easy stuff. I wanted your stuff, right? And I was always kind of like gaming in my mind on how to get that stuff without having to work for it or be accountable for it. Today, I don't have that appetite. I don't have those appetites to go out and rob people or to break the law. I don't have those appetites today. So really, those defects, those things, those driving forces that would have me do those criminal acts have dissipated. I don't believe that they're gone. But it's the subtler ones that are really, really, you know, devious in me. You know, the self-righteousness. The judgment, being critical. Well, I'm being critical because I think they need a hard criticism in order for them to get right. You know what I mean? It's like, but that's, you know, I don't know what that is. See, I think it's just the innate drive to control. Right? It's kind of like this is a temple. God created me to house Him. So I believe when I was born, I was like this vessel that he could dwell in until I started to get contaminated with all these rights and wrongs and, you know, this is what's, you know, all that stuff that we get indoctrinated with as children coming up, you know, that we really mold and harden as we get older, right? And I believe that the vessel was not able to house my Creator because of all this stuff, all this garbage that got in the way. That man right there told me, he says, Joe, he says, God will never live in a cesspool. He'll never dwell in a cesspool. My thoughts, in my mind, was a cesspool before I got here. I was always seeking something for nothing. Always wanting something for nothing, right? And it's kind of like the temple that I had. It's kind of like, you know, I was thinking about it today. It's like, you know, you see it. You can envision a temple or a church or something like that, and it's painted one particular way. And we come in and we paint it a different color. You know, and it's beautiful. The problem is that the original color's underneath. And I believe that's what happens with me, right? That I was a perfect, pure vessel when I was born. And then as time went on, and appetites and desires started to be created, and selfishness started to take over, I started to paint. I started to paint, right? And even today, the paint that I wear today is a color that's much better than what I was before I got here. And it's much better than the year that after I got here. And I believe that it's a fairly decent color today. And that I'm able to sense my Creator. I'm able to really get close with Him and have this relationship and have Him indwell me at times. But what happens is I'll go out and I'll get hurt. We get hurt. You know, somebody might offend us. And it chips that paint. Or I don't get what I thought I wanted to get at the job, and the boss fires me, and it chips that paint. You know, or I get in an accident, or I get in a calamity, and it chips that paint. And all of a sudden, I look in the mirror, and I'm a bunch of chips, and all that's showing is what I've attempted to become, covered up by who I've always been. I see the original paint on the inside. I got to work on that stuff. I don't believe these defects ever go away. I believe that what we do is we with sincere desire, we attempt to become somebody different because we know what that gets us, right? So if I'm a habitual liar, I start telling the truth and I surround myself with people that if I start to embellish the truth, or if I start to say something that might not resemble the truth, they call me on it because they love me. That's a stand. That's not a sellout. Right? Or if I attempt to want to take a shortcut, or if I attempt to want to do something in a dishonorable way, I either have the wherewithal to look in the mirror and say, no, this is not who I want to be. But I also have my men around me that will call me on my thing, right? And what happens is that through the ease and comfort that comes by doing the right thing, by seeking His love and His protection in a relationship with Him, the ease and comfort that comes from that is way better than anything that I could concoct through selfish means. I'd much rather be basking when we do that little meditation and we do that prayer. We get in that room, we do that prayer, you know, together. I'd much rather have that feeling and that emotion and that ease and comfort than the one that's going to be followed by guilt and shame and remorse and resentment and bitterness that eventually will get me restless, irritable, and discontent. To where everything that I'm seeking to get a sense of ease and comfort, to get away from that, stops working. And at the worst time ever, somebody walks up to me and says, hey man, you straight? You all right? I got what you need. And I'm gone. It's happened for decades in my life. And I hope to God I never get to that point. But if I'm not doing this work, it's absolutely going to happen. It's absolutely going to happen. It can't not happen. Right? So we get to come in here. Not who we are, but who we've become. And with sincere desire, we get to do this work and become who He created us to be. That is far greater than anything we could have ever imagined. And at the end of this stage, we step out to the people that we hurt, and we're ready to set right the wrongs. And we'll talk about that next week. Thanks.
Hey, guys, let's have another round of applause for Joe. I got Fred with our secretary report.
Good evening. My name is Fred, and I'm your recovered alcoholic secretary.
Hey, Fred.
In keeping with the Severn tradition, which states that every group shall be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions, the baskets are now going around. I've asked Jerry to read the recovered statement. We read this notice to explain why many people in this group identify as recovered rather than recovering, and what it exactly means to be a recovered alcoholic.
Jerry, I'm a recovering alcoholic.
Jerry.
Recovered. We are not cured of alcoholism. Recovered, but not cured. That presents a conflict to some alcoholics. If we were cured, we would be able to drink responsibly. No, we are not cured. The allergic reaction to alcohol will remain with us for our lifetime. We have been restored to sanity. That was the problem. The main problem of the alcoholic centers in his mind rather than in the body. We are now sane where alcohol is concerned. Consequently, we have recovered.
...1940-style Big Book sponsorship, from the forward to the second edition, Alcoholics Anonymous. Of alcoholics who came to AA and really tried, 50% got sobered at once and remained that way, 25% sobered up after some relapses, and among the remainder, those who stayed on with AA showed improvement. What we've seen, felt, and come to believe and experience is that God has not changed over time, and neither should the sacred approach back to his loving arms. The statistics above suggest a 75% success rate. Can I have a show of hands of recovered alcoholics? Is there anyone in need of a sponsor tonight? Please raise your hand. Would you stand up for a moment, please? Everyone who's available for sponsorship, can you please meet with them after the meeting? Please join us Monday night. We have a Big Book study meeting on the third floor in the same building where the Big Book comes alive. Fellowship is at 6:30 and the meeting itself starts at 7:15. We have large print Big Book and Big Book dictionaries for sale. We meet every Thursday starting promptly at 8:15, and we ask that you be courteous and ready to begin at the sound of the bells. Thank you guys, and I'll see you next week.
We have all tonight's sessions and all the past speaker podcasts online for free at alcoholicsandgod.org. I'd like to invite everyone, like Fred said, to our Monday night Big Book study. We're really getting into working with others now, and it's been a treat, so come on down. And those who wish to thank tonight's speaker, please line up down the center aisle, and we're going to close in our seats with the Lord's Prayer. Our Father. See you all next Monday or Thursday. Godspeed.
When you laughing, bah, 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 oh, when you laughing, yes, the sun comes shining through. But when you crying, bring on the rain. So stop your sighing, baby, and be happy again. Yes, and keep on smiling. Keep on smiling, baby.